morning I'm going to be talking on Sangha Rachita and the new society. So what I'm going to try and do, first of all, is to give a bit of a context in which Sangha Rachita formulated his ideas around the new society. Secondly, to look at what Sangha Rachita identified as the key role of Buddhists in bringing about the new society, three particular aspects of that role. Thirdly, to look at some of the problems, recognizing that there have been problems in implementing and maintaining the basic building blocks of the new society, particularly in relation to team-based right livelihoods and communities. And fourthly, to consider what we might do in relation to revitalizing or revisiting the idea of the new society, particularly in relation to the areas of work and community. And there'll be some final words on Sangha Rachita about individuality and individualism. Okay, so that's what I'm going to try and cover this morning. So first of all, the context in which Banti formulated his ideas about the new society. And there's three particular aspects of the context in which Banti did formulate the ideas for the new society that I want to highlight. The first is that Sangha Rachita was steeped in the Pali Canon, in the teachings of the Buddha as contained in the Pali Canon. And from those teachings, he would have picked up several things. Do you think we could... Is that the tea machine? Downstairs, okay.
There's nothing we can do.
Okay, all right. So the first thing is he would have appreciated just how radical the Buddha was in his time. The Buddha was a radical. And two examples of that. First one relating to caste. And the Buddha did a very simple thing. He had a rule that the monks and nuns were not allowed to keep food or to cook their own food. They couldn't hoard food. They couldn't carry anything with them. Each day they had to go into the nearest village or town and stand and receive the gift of food from people in those villages and towns. And the Buddha was clear that they could not go to their favourite houses. They could not indicate what kinds of food they liked. They had to turn up and simply progress through the village or the town, visiting whatever properties were there, whatever caste the people in those houses belonged to. And in this way, it usurps the role of caste. The Sangha were not allowed to choose where they went for food in relation to the place in the caste system that the people had who lived in particular houses. So that's quite revolutionary and sent out a very strong revolutionary message to people in the villages and the towns. That's the first thing as an example of his radicalism. The second example is to do with the ordination of women. Now, there's a lot of stories in the Pali Canon around the ordination of women, particularly. The general story, the given story that we hear a lot about, is how difficult it was in some ways to persuade the Buddha to ordain women, that he had to be persuaded by Ananda to allow women to become nuns, to go forth and be ordained as nuns. And the fact of the matter is that he did ordain women as nuns. They did go forth, and that was quite revolutionary in itself. But there's been quite a lot of research done on the text in the Pali Canon, particularly by a man called Bhikkhu Anālayo. Some of you may be familiar with Anālayo from his books, two books on the Satipatthana, Sutta, on mindfulness. And Bhikkhu Anālayo has studied various collections of the Pali Canon in Pali and the Chinese versions. And he's done a close textual scholarly analysis. And that analysis suggests that a lot of what is in the story surrounding the ordination of women was added after the Buddha's death. That basically some monks, at least, found it culturally difficult to accept that women and that nuns were equal to monks. And so that the stories about the difficulty in persuading the Buddha to accept women as nuns were added later, and the rules that the nuns had to follow that made them, if you like, lower than the most recently ordained monk were added later. And Analio says that actually, if you do a careful reading of the text, the most likely story is quite a simple one, and that is that Mahaprajapati went to the Buddha and said, I wish to go forth. I wish you to ordain me as a nun. The Buddha was concerned because of the dangers that were there for a woman, for a nun, walking on their own, going forth in the wilderness and wandering around. They were at great danger of being assaulted, raped, and murdered. That was his concern. He said to her, he said, what you should do is shave your head, wear the robes, lead a celibate life, and stay close to home for safety reasons. I'm not prepared at the moment. I think it's unwise for you to fully go forth and wander. So that's the initial event. Then what happens is that Mahaprajapati and other women decide in any case that they are going to follow the Buddha. So they wander around the countryside following the Buddha. And when the Buddha sees this and realizes that it is possible for them to do it safely, he ordains them as nuns. That, Analio says, is the most likely story of what happened. So there was no great difficulty surrounding it. The Buddha's concern only to begin with was with their safety. So he ordained nuns. He ordained women as nuns. That's a second radical step. But Sangharaksha would also have noticed that the Buddha gave many teachings to lay people. Of course, the majority of his teachings that are recorded in the Pali Canon are to monks and nuns, but there's a substantial section of teachings that he gave to lay people. He was concerned for the stability and well-being of society as a whole. He realized that if enlightenment was going to be open to all, then certain conditions needed to be met in society. So that, first of all, there needed to be the basic needs of life. Decent shelter, food, water, and so on had to be provided. There had to be a stable economy, because a stable economy would allow for surplus food, so that the Buddha's followers and all the other holy wanderers who actually went out into the villages and the towns to receive their food could receive food. That required a surplus to be produced. And people needed to have enough time for reflection, so that they were not spending all their time seeking the basic needs of life. So he had this general concern for the well-being and happiness of everyone, and for everyone to be able to make the most of their potential as a human being. So he saw the importance of good governance, and he also saw the importance of the Sangha within the context of the wider society. And the classic example of this is what's known as the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta, which translates as the lion's roar on the wheel-turning monarch. The lion's roar, when the Buddha gave a teaching, it said it's like a lion roaring. The lion's roar on the wheel-turning monarch. This is a story told by the Buddha. And a wheel-turning monarch is so called because, according to myth, a radiant wheel gem appears as a symbol of just rule. And if the symbol disappears, then it indicates that something is wrong with the method of rule. So this wheel gem cannot be passed down as an inheritance from one monarch to another, but must be earned afresh by the just governance of each new monarch. So there's one particular monarch, a wheel-turning monarch, who seeks advice. He's concerned about the future of his kingdom. And he's told that everything will be fine so long as you fulfill certain conditions. First, that you seek the counsel of wise people of high integrity, that you yourself follow the teachings of the Buddha on morality and wisdom, that you protect all of your people, that you prevent crime, and that you meet the needs of the poor. And in this way, the rule would be just and the symbol of the wheel gem would remain visible. So the Buddha tells the story that the king followed this advice, and for seven generations his descendants followed his example, each of them by their own policies and actions, renewing the symbol of the wheel gem. Eventually, however, one of the descendants begins to neglect the poor. As a consequence of this neglect, poverty becomes widespread. As poverty spreads, the poor had no means to make a living, so some of them began to steal from those who had what they needed. In order to forestall the increase in theft, the king introduces capital punishment. Thieves then begin to arm themselves to protect themselves from the police. This leads to a general increase in weapons among the population as people with property take up arms to protect themselves against the thieves. And as more and more people take up weapons, murder increases in the population. As crime increases, law enforcement becomes tougher and more indiscriminate. People fearing arrest begin to lie. Meanwhile, some people see an opportunity to get their rivals into trouble with the law and begin making accusations against their neighbours. And this eventually leads to a breakdown in people's trust for one another. So trust erodes, animosity increases. People cared less and less for each other. And eventually this leads to a situation of incessant strife among the population. So the Buddha tells the dismal story of a descent into chaos that eventually results from neglect of the poor by the monarch. So we can see the role of good governance and what happens when you lose it. But then the Buddha continues the story, and this is where the Sangha comes in. And he tells how the situation was eventually reversed. He tells us how a few people grow tired of the chaos and simply decide they're going to go off somewhere remote and secluded and live differently. Basically, they decide to live according to the Buddha's ethical guidelines. That's what they do. Eventually, others see this group of people living together in harmony, see that they're happier and more prosperous than those who fought with each other, and more people go and join them. And gradually, the conditions are reversed. Gradually, the situation is turned around, and finally, a government is established that looks after the poor. So basically, the people who grew tired of the fighting and went off and lived together lived as a Buddhist spiritual community. They lived as a Sangha, and they influenced and changed the wider society. I think that's a really important teaching by the Buddha. So that's like the first part of the context for Sangharakshita's ideas about the new society, being aware of the teachings of the Buddha. The second part of the context relates to what we heard yesterday from Vajratara about Dr. Ambedkar. Sangharakshita had direct contact with Dr. Ambedkar and with his followers after his death. And from the experience of the Dalits that Sangharakshita observed, he understood that it was not possible to transform individual lives without a corresponding transformation of the collective life of society. What he saw in India was not just a revival of Buddhism, but a tremendous positive upheaval brought about in a society by spiritual means. And this, in part at least, is what led him to conclude, that led Sangharakshita to conclude, that a sufficiently alert and inspired group of Buddhist practitioners, of dedicated Buddhist practitioners, working together, could exert a substantial influence on whole societies, especially where those societies were in a state of flux, looking for some kind of vision or blueprint for the future. That's the second part of the context, the influence of what he'd seen and experienced in India through the work of Dr. Ambedkar and his followers. And the third part of the context that I wanted to mention is this. It's to do with Sangharakshita himself, his history and the times in which he lived. You know, he's quite an eccentric man with a very different kind of story of life to most people. But he came out of a family, I think at least Subhuti refers to it, like his father's supposed to have had socialist leanings. And I know, because when I asked for ordination, I wrote to Sangharakshita and I told him about my background in trade unions. And I got a typed letter back from Sangharakshita in which he said, had he returned from India at the end of the Second World War, it is possible that his uncle would have found him a position in the trade union and cooperative movement. And then he said, as you know, things turned out a bit different. But I found that very interesting, that there is that part of English society, especially Second World War and afterwards, where things like the trade union cooperative movement were a much more visible part of the fabric of society. And that so that's a part of Sangharakshita's leanings. I'm not going to claim that he's a socialist, but there's something there in that background. The other thing is, it's really important, I think, to be aware of the context of the 1960s and the 1970s after Sangharakshita returned from India, and the context in which he founded our order and movement. Basically, these were quite turbulent times. In the 1960s, there was a lot of change happening. You had student revolts, all sorts of great promise, great hopes that were ultimately disappointed, crushing disappointments, especially in the late 60s with the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and so on. And the descent into violence of some aspects of the hippie movement in the 1960s. But in the 60s and 70s, there was still, into the 70s, widespread experimentation with different ways of living. So that you had a huge interest in communes, loads and loads of books on communes, communal living. Huge movements of squats in London, empty properties being squatted and occupied. Ideas around free love, all sorts of radical ideas floating around. So that the experiments, if you like, in the way of living and working that started to happen within our movement in the 1970s, in which Banti began to put into words and formulate with the ideas of the new society, were part of that spirit of the times. So that's an important context to be aware of, that there were things happening, and that what was happening in Sri Ratna, the FWBO as it then was not that unusual. So that's the context in which the ideas of the new society came about. So what was the basic idea, if you like? What was the key feature that Banti formulated, what he began to pull together into a vision of the new society? Well, it was to do with what he called the nucleus of a new society. And this is the creation of situations in which people live and work together on the basis of Buddhism. If you like, new societies in miniature. This is where the idea of the three C's, of centres, communities and cooperatives, what later became team-based right livelihood, they fit in with this idea of new societies in miniature. And Sangharakshita said that these new societies in miniature, that the nucleus of the new society, had three particularly important functions. The first is to support those who are already committed to Buddhism, and I'll explain what that means in a minute. The second is to provide points of contact for those who are exploring the Buddhist life. And the third is to exemplify what the wider society could become. So I'll go into those three, looking at those three now. So, mutual support for those already committed to Buddhism. Sangharakshita said this is necessary because the work of creating a new society requires a great deal of energy and strength, and few have that strength on their own. They need to live with or be in regular contact with or even work with or live with people who share the same aspiration and who are struggling to realize the same ideals in their lives. They need the support of instruction and guidance from others to help learn how to apply Buddhism to the concrete realities of daily life. The task of social transformation requires a vast amount of energy and a wide range of talents, skills, and experience. And he thought it's only possible to carry it out on a significant scale when people cooperate together, pooling their efforts and their capacities through creative teamwork. That's the first thing about mutual support. The second thing that he realized, and I think this is particularly important as well, is that such a collective basis is also an important support for those individual Buddhists who wish to become more directly involved in political issues or in social issues, who wish to go out and engage with political and social movements in the outside world. He thought that without immersion in the nucleus of a new society, without deep immersion in the Buddhist Sangha, political activity could easily take people over. And I know this from my own observations in terms of being involved in trade union political movements. I've seen it many, many times. The people who start with genuine social and political aspirations, with genuine ideals, who want to help others, can easily be submerged in the struggle for power. It can suck you in and pull you away from your ideals. So the foundation of active involvement in spiritual community, in a Buddhist spiritual community, is indispensable if people are to work effectively to transform society whilst retaining their high intention and ideals. I would take it a little bit further in a way. The basis for being able to engage with the wider political and social world is, first of all, to maintain a consistent and deep individual spiritual practice. That's essential. But to be doing that in the context of involvement in a Sangha with brothers and sisters to whom you talk regularly, that you relay your experience, you talk about it, you learn from what they are advising you as well. That you need to have that as the basis for stepping out to engage in the wider world. So that's the first function of the nucleus of the new society. The second function is to provide a point of contact for those who are exploring the Buddhist life. So it offers opportunity for contact to those who cannot or do not wish to live or work full time with Buddhist brothers and sisters. So this is why we have Buddhist classes, retreats, festivals, other events and situations where people can come and get support and guidance and inspiration that will help them to maintain their values in the outside world where they live. It's like as if you can come and stay for a while in a kind of spiritual oasis where you can refresh yourself. So having those places is essential. And I think the basic idea was that people could move in and out. People could move into living or working within that nucleus. They can go out. There's the possibility to move in and out. So when you go on retreat, when you attend a Buddhist centre, you go to the Sangha night or whatever, you're going in for a little while, then you come back out. Or you might actually go and spend time for a year or two working in a right livelihood business or working at a centre. Those were the sort of possibilities that were in Sangharakshita's mind. So that was the second function of this nucleus. And the third function of a nucleus of a new society is to provide an example of what the whole of society could be like. To provide an example of what the whole of society could be like. So I don't know what you felt when you first attended a Triratna Buddhist Centre. I remember I was just incredibly struck by the experience. I think many people experience this. You visit. Maybe you come to an urban Buddhist centre or you go to a retreat centre and you immediately feel something different. There's something different in the atmosphere, in the way people relate, in the way they welcome you, in the way that they behave. It can be quite subtle. Something is being asserted, something is being kept alive that affects everyone, however subtly and unconsciously. I hope Mogavangsa will forgive me, but I'm going to tell a little story about when I came along to the Sheffield. It wasn't the Sheffield Buddhist Centre in those days, was it? Because you were living with a few other men in the men's community. And the classes, like the introductory class that I attended, took place in a room in Sheffield University off West Street in the centre of Sheffield. Later we moved to a community centre where we would have regular Sangha nights and so on. But I arrived one evening at this class. I was struck immediately by just how friendly the people were who greeted me. Gave me a cup of tea, gave me biscuits, chatted to me. And then we had this amazing experience over several weeks of watching Amoghavangsa and Smriti Ratna teach us meditation. And I'm not exaggerating when I say I have never experienced anything like that before in my life. And I have one particular memory because it was just so outrageous. I couldn't believe that anybody would do this. But Amoghavaksha stood up at the start of 1 week and he said, I've been told we need to make it a bit more funny and engaging. And I thought, blimey, this is weird enough already. And he said, so, and I can't remember what the topic was. It was something, let's say it's hindrances. So he says, first hindrance, and he pulls out a balloon. And he blows up a balloon, and written on this balloon is desire. First hindrance, desire. And then he lets the balloon go, it goes around the room. Then he pulls out a second balloon, blows it up with another word written on it. It gives that, and the little teaching, and lets it go, and it goes around. And this was just utterly, utterly amazing. And I just thought, you know, that anybody who can do this, there's something going on. Because I was a teacher in adult education, and I thought, I could never do that. I could never do that. But there was a whole set of people in that room who were caught by the behaviour. Atcher, I can think of, and others who are order members now, who were caught in that room. We all went at the same time by the atmosphere that was there. So I just wanted to mention that because I think it's a great story. Yeah. So there's an atmosphere. But there is something else about exemplification. It can be quite explicit. And I think that we underestimate, actually, what we exemplify. For example, with the Dana economy, I don't think we appreciate just quite how big an example this is in terms of how the world can be different. So the basic idea in the Dana economy is give what you can, take what you need. It's very interesting. We had Liberty, Equality, Fraternity yesterday, and echoes of Marx, and again echoes of Marx. Give what you can, take what you need. Actually, that idea has been around from well before the Communist Manifesto. Now, the precise details of how a Dana economy works can differ from one sangha to another. But there are certain basic features, I think, which are very clear and very important. Well, the first is that if there's a Dana economy, those who come to classes are encouraged to give what they can afford to help enable the spread of the Dharma. And at the same time, the teachings of the Buddha are open to anyone, regardless of individual financial circumstances. They're open to anyone, regardless of individual financial circumstances. That's a truly radical thing to do. I live in Estonia, and I notice there's many New Age movements and classes. And I cannot believe the prices that people have to pay to attend those New Age movements and classes. And we are often told, you don't charge anything. You charge too little. People are astonished that we provide things at very little or no cost. So that's the first thing. But there's another aspect which I think is particularly relevant in the modern economy, is this. That if you work at a Buddhist center or at a retreat center or in a right livelihood business, the level of support that you need, is that you are given, is decided on exactly the same principles, whatever your position is within that center. It doesn't matter how more advanced you might be in terms of spiritual hierarchy, whether you're the director of a center or you're just someone who helps around the centre, you are given what you need. The principle is the same. So that I remember living at Padmaloka, because I was the treasurer, I handled all the support for the 18 men who lived there, and we were all pretty much on exactly the same levels of support. Almost exactly the same levels of support. It didn't matter how long you had been involved in Tri Ratna, how senior a position you had in the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, that everyone is paid according to their needs. That is a truly radical principle in the modern world. You give according to the best of your ability, and you take what you need. So I just want to emphasise that, because think about what happens now in the outside world in terms of pay. When I was writing the book, I was doing some research looking at figures for the United States. In the 1970s in the United States, a chief executive officer of a company on average would earn 26 times as much money as the average worker in that company. And people thought that was much too high. There was a very famous management consultant, a man called Peter Drucker. He was probably the most famous management consultant in the West. And he thought the absolute upper limit should be 20-to-1 ratio. The ratio now in the United States is over 200-to-1. And in the UK, the head of a company or a finance organisation on average earns 130 times as much as the average worker in their organisation. So that what we do, what we have, what we take for granted is truly radical. And we ought to be aware of that and talk more about it. And I was thinking, originally I think I wrote in the book that maybe there's too big a gap, you know, we can't really start arguing for equal pay for everyone, whatever their level, because it would just be too much. But there's two things that have happened, or things that have been drawn to my attention in the last year or so, I think which are quite significant. You may be aware that last year there was a referendum in Switzerland, you know, one of the most conservative countries in Europe, on should there be a maximum upper ratio of the earnings of the people who run a company or financial organisation compared to the pay of the average worker. And it was brought up, I think it was a referendum that was initiated by a group of young socialists. And they said the maximum ratio should be 12-to-1. And that was what the question was on the referendum. Do you agree that Switzerland should impose a maximum pay ratio of 12-to-1? Now, it was lost, but 35% of the Swiss population who voted in that referendum voted in favour of that 12-to-1 ratio, which I think is quite extraordinary. The second thing that's been brought to my attention is there is a renewed interest, a revival in cooperative businesses. And the major cooperative in the world is an organisation called Mondragon from Spain. It's a collection of cooperatives in different businesses, working from heavy industry to retail to banking and education. Altogether, their businesses employ 75,000 employees. And they have a principle which they enforce, which is that within any cooperative, and they can be quite big, their cooperatives, no manager can make more than 6 times the salary of the lowest paid worker in that co-op. No manager can make more than 6 times the salary of the lowest paid worker in that co-op. So there is something there, something going on. And I think that we could be talking more about our principles in that area.
There's something going on in Japan as well, actually.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yes. Yes.
With the top exec in the Japanese airlines.
Yeah.
Deciding to reduce his pay.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you see, because in Japan, it's very when you compare the levels of inequality in income of different countries around the world, the countries that have the lowest amount of inequality are Japan and Sweden. And in Japan, it's because historically they've always had much narrower pay differentials between the chief executive officers of companies and the workers. In Sweden, they have quite wide-ranging pay differentials, but they have an incredibly powerful system of progressive taxation and a huge system of welfare benefits, so they redistribute the income. But in Japan, it's true that pay levels are much closer, and there is a spirit there, of actually seeing that this is important. Okay. So, the Dana economy is one important way in which the nucleus of a new society, our centres or retreat centres or businesses or whatever, can exemplify values for the wider society. But I think that when we're looking at how the new society ideals have been put into practice, we have to acknowledge that fulfilling the ideal has not always been easy. And it's been particularly difficult since the 1990s. So it's been difficult since the 1990s to sustain the same level of interest in participating in right livelihood businesses and in communities. Although I'm picking up, travelling around, actually, that there is a renewal of interest in living in communities, that people seem to be being attracted back into living in communities in a way that they've not been for some time. But with the demise of Windhorse Trading and Evolution, the biggest right team-based right livelihood business has disappeared. And it's certainly the case that very few right livelihood businesses have survived for any length of time. We've had all sorts of right livelihood businesses, particularly cafes, gardening businesses, building businesses, you name it, at different times, but nothing has ever been sustained for any great length of time, except you could say that sort of running an urban Buddhist centre and a retreat centre, in effect, that is a team-based right livelihood. And they survive and survive well. So there's an issue here. Why is it? Why has it been hard? Why has it been hard to sustain the practical implementation of the ideals of the new society? And I don't have any answers on this, but I do believe it's... You can't just exhort people to live in that way. There has to be... People have to want to live in that way and to see good reasons for doing it, to be attracted towards it. So I was trying to think through why has it been that there's been a decline, particularly in right, like team-based right livelihood businesses and until recently in communities. And I think part of it must be to do with the rising pressures of a consumerist society. Since the 1990s, and through into the 2000s, there's been a massive rise in the emphasis on individualism and consumerism. It's in the air in a way that I don't remember it being in the air before the 1990s. And it must have an effect. It seeps into the consciousness of everybody, including in the Buddhist community. And perhaps we have underestimated the influence on Buddhist practitioners of the pervasive social and economic environment. Maybe we've ignored that side of it, that we've neglected what's been happening there. And Sangharakshita actually warned of the danger of ignoring this social and economic dimension. He said, "In as much as the world acts upon you, it is in your interest that it does so in a helpful rather than in a harmful way. That means you have an interest in the particular way in which worldly affairs are organized or run. If you are living in an unideal community or state, it is going to have an unfortunate effect upon you. You therefore have an interest in the creation of an ideal state or community." So he's saying that, I think he was warning, don't underestimate the influence of wider society upon you as Buddhist practitioners. And I've had a little bit of correspondence with Vishwapani, who's been involved very much in our order and movement, particularly since the 1990s, and been involved in very much, I think, helping to formulate the direction of the order and the movement, and also giving historical accounts of what's happened. And he's written, if you like, a very supportive critique of my book. But he makes a comment, and I'm just going to see if I can actually summarise it a little bit. But he says that I mention about the influence of individualism and consumerism upon us. So he says, Vadaka ascribes the relative decline in engagement with these, that's communities and team-based right livelihood, to the effects of consumerism and individualism. No doubt that plays a role. But a bigger factor, in my view, is that many people, myself included, have wanted living and working situations that meet their needs rather than fitting in with what is possible in collective situations. So just say that again. Many people have wanted living and working situations that meet their needs rather than fitting with what is possible in collective situations. We have wanted to follow our vocations, and in many cases, these have involved engaging with people who are suffering. Some of us have become mindfulness teachers, others are yoga teachers, psychotherapists, mediators, teachers, medical workers, and so on. Many people who are doing this sort of work feel they are finding effective ways to express their Buddhist practice. In effect, he argues, they are following a different model of Buddhist-inspired social change. Seeking to create a more ideal world set apart from mainstream society, in fact, establishes an enclave within it. In other words, he's saying that the idea of a nucleus of team-based right livelihood businesses or communities establishing an enclave. Many people may wish to inhabit such a space for some years, but perhaps not the whole of their lives. We need such enclaves. So he's not saying we don't need to have things like team-based right livelihoods and communities, but we also need to embrace what is happening. We need a vision of Buddhist-inspired social change that encompasses what other people are doing. It needs to include, for example, the mainstream mindfulness movement. And we need to find allies among activists and workers in the caring professions and elsewhere with whom our values overlap. So I'm just putting that out there as a point of view, I think, which is expressing something which maybe quite a few people feel. And I think in a way I'm going to return to talking about it in a minute in relation to work and community. So that's out there from Vishapani. I want to open up now a broader discussion. How are we doing for time? Do we need a break?
Yes, please.
Do you have a break? Maybe then I'll continue to talk after the break. Is that okay?
Yes.
So you have what, 10 minutes if you want to get a cup of tea and bring it back up?
There's a pause in theme.
Sorry?
If there's a pause in theme, it's
yeah. Do we want to pause that?
I just looked everywhere and had a stone for balloons. I found these. It's amazing what you find in a shrine cupboard.
Okay, that was recorded as well. Okay, so I want to start now by looking at the world of work and just discussing what we might do or what are the issues in relation to the world of work and the new society. So the background to this is that I was reading this report, research carried on out around most of the countries in the world, that a quarter of all workers in the world are actively disengaged from their jobs, hate their jobs. A quarter of all workers in the world actively hate their jobs. Two-thirds are lacking in motivation. In other words, they're not really engaged, but it's manageable. And only one in eight workers are fully committed to their job. But however bad it is for those who are in work, it's even worse for those who are out of work. Having no work is the worst of all, and there are over 200 million people who are unemployed.
Worldwide.
Worldwide, yeah. And I think something like a quarter of those are under the age of 25. So that's the background to it. Now, to consider the world of work, I want actually to turn to E.F. Schumacher, who wrote this wonderful book, Small is Beautiful, that was published in the late 60s, in which there is a chapter called Buddhist Economics. And a lot of that chapter is concerned with the world of work. And he sets out what he thinks is the Buddhist attitude towards work. And this is what he says. He says, a Buddhist would see work as having three main purposes. The first is to give a person the opportunity to make the most of their potential. To give a person the opportunity to make the most of their potential. The second is to help them to overcome their ego-centeredness by joining with other people in a common task. To help people to overcome their ego-centeredness by joining with other people in a common task. And thirdly, to produce the goods and services needed for a becoming existence. In other words, to produce goods and services that add something real to the sense of well-being in society. And he goes on, to organise work in such a manner that it becomes meaningless, boring, stultifying or nerve-wracking for the worker would be little short of criminal. It would indicate a greater concern with goods than with people, an evil lack of compassion, and a soul-destroying degree of attachment to the most primitive side of this worldly existence. And he says, equally, to strive for leisure as an alternative to work would be considered a complete misunderstanding of one of the basic truths of human existence, namely that work and leisure are complementary parts of the same living process and cannot be separated without destroying the joy of work and the bliss of leisure. I really recommend reading his essay on Buddhist economics. It's very interesting. There's another man called Arthur Zionk. He's the president of what's called the Mind and Life Institute, which is the body that conducts all the dialogue between the Dalai Lama and scientists and so on. And he talks about why work is important. He sees himself as very much in the tradition of Schumacher. And he says, through work, as well as learning skills, we educate ourselves morally. He says, what we do shapes who we are, as well as produces the goods and services needed for life. If we do something that is demeaning or soul-crushing, then what we do gradually works its way inside us and debilitates and demoralizes us, diminishing our full capacity. If, on the other hand, we can find a way of working by fashioning convivial tools with which to work, then work can be ennobling, it can be nourishing, and the full capacity of our own humanity can unfold through that nourishment. So what Schumacher and Zionk are doing is asserting or reasserting the primacy of work as part of fulfilling life. I think that's being lost sight of in the wider society. Primacy of work as part of a fulfilling life. Work is often seen now as a means to an end, money as a means to an end. But there's another side to the modern view of work, which is an obsession, actually. And that obsession is an obsession with productivity and efficiency. So it's like the holy grail of economics is to increase the amount of output delivered per person per hour. Everything is measured in terms of how much is a person producing per hour. That's how you measure productivity. And what's happening is, with the increasing use of more and more machinery and new technology and so on, is that overall productivity is going up. But what that means is, if our economies don't continue to expand, if our economies don't continue to grow, then there's going to be less and less work to do, less and less work to go around. And unemployment is likely to rise. If we continue with the obsession in productivity, unemployment is going to go sky high. So there's an issue here. What do we do about productivity and efficiency and this potential technological unemployment? There's a very interesting book written by a man called Tim Jackson called Prosperity Without Growth. And he talks a lot about productivity. He basically says, well, in relation to this problem of technological unemployment, there are two solutions which are not mutually exclusive. One is to reduce the length of the working week, and so that everybody should work 20 or 25 hours a week and share work around. But the second is, actually, seems completely non-intuitive, which is to expand work in those areas which are least productive and efficient. To expand work in those areas which are least productive and efficient. In other words, let go of the relentless pursuit of productivity. Now, what does he mean by this? He means that what are the low productivity sectors? They are the caring professions of medicine, social work, education, and so on. It's crafts and it's culture. So he's formulating three C's, a different three C's to communities, centres and co-ops, but three C's here of caring, crafts and culture. He says chasing productivity in these areas, efficiency, doesn't make any sense, because to do those jobs well relies on people giving their time and attention and care. Taking time. Giving people more time to do their jobs, not less. In other words, what happens is, how is a doctor's productivity measured? How many patients they see in a day? There's no measure of what's the quality of engagement? What's the quality of the care? How does the person receiving the advice feel? How does the doctor or the nurse feel when they are unable to give sufficient time? So Jackson is arguing that instead of imposing meaningless productivity targets, we should be looking to improve the quality of care and the experience of the caregiver. That the two go hand in hand, that you can't separate the two. He says, the care and concern of one human being for another is a peculiar commodity. It can't be stockpiled. It becomes degraded through trade. It isn't delivered by machines. Its quality rests entirely on the attention paid by one person to another. To speak of reducing the time involved is to completely misunderstand its value. I think this echoes in some way what Vishapani was pointing to. He was talking about these kinds of professions or vocations, in one sense, as being a possible area for us to explore. But Jackson also points to crafts and to culture. So with crafts, it's accuracy and detail that give them lasting values. And that comes about time and attention, time spent training. Yeah. I remember in the 50s when I was a young boy, in the 60s even, you know, it was really sought out. People wanted apprenticeships, and there were lots of apprenticeships and trades and things. And you don't really get that. I mean, there's a pale imitation of it now around, but it's, they were like 5-year or 10-year apprenticeships. and really learning trades and so on. So crafts is one, and the cultural sector is another. Because here again, it's the time that the artist, whatever part of the cultural sector is, that spends practicing, learning their discipline, rehearsing, and so on. Jackson says rhetorically, what aside from meaningless noise would be gained by asking the New York Philharmonic to play Beethoven's Ninth Symphony faster and faster each year? And what he says is that he says the modern tendency to view low productivity as a disease highlights the lunacy at the heart of the growth-obsessed, resource-intensive consumer economy. So he's make up. He says we end up in a ridiculous situation where a whole set of activities that could provide meaningful work and contribute valuable services to the community are denigrated because they involve employing people to work with devotion, patience, and attention. So he's making an argument that to restore the value of decent work to its rightful place at the heart of society, we should be expanding work in those three areas of caring, crafts, and culture. Now, when I was reading around it, it's interesting because Sangharakshita also gave some advice in different set of circumstances on work. This was, I think, it's based on something that he spoke about in 1968, so a different time period. I'll come back to that. So Sangharakshita did talk about the value of work as a vocation. If you had a vocation, like working in the caring professions or teaching or whatever it was, this was really important. That was a good, right livelihood. But in the absence of working at a job that is a vocation, for an individual Buddhist, he said, and in the context of an overall ethical approach, he said there are certain aspects of work that need attention if you are interested in pursuing right livelihood. So first of all, he talked about three different types of jobs that should be avoided. And the first, he said, was anything like working in a slaughterhouse or in the manufacture of armaments, he said, cannot be right for a Buddhist under any circumstances. I'm going to come back to that because I think there is a qualification to that. But he said the first is like working in a slaughterhouse or in an armaments factory, cannot be right for a Buddhist under any circumstances. The second is, he's concerned about jobs that involve deliberately increasing people's greed and distraction and desire, such as might be found in advertising or sales promotion. These should be avoided by Buddhists. And thirdly, he said, there are occupations that involve, for individuals, significant mental strain and tension. And if you're in a kind of job that causes you a lot of mental strain and tension, such, for example, that meditation becomes difficult, you really need to consider whether you should stay in that kind of job. So he gave some basic advice there.
Yeah.
The second one was jobs which involve deliberately increasing people's greed or desire. And he said such as advertising or sales promotion. He also said that if you are working in a job which for you is simply a means to earn a living, then you need to think quite carefully, if at all possible, about keeping your working hours to the minimum required to earn enough to live off, so that you could free up space to devote time to Buddhist practice and to the spreading of the Dharma. An interesting thought, if you are able to earn enough from working less than full-time and your job is just a means to live and you don't have any particular vocation or interest otherwise in it, that's a consideration. Now, he outlined these considerations in 1968. And I'm emphasising that because at that time, I think unemployment was probably around about 300 or 400,000 people. Very high for the time. very high for the 1960s. 400,000, I think, was the highest level of unemployment in the 1960s. In other words, you could be pretty sure that if you were out of work, it would be temporary and there would always be something that you could go and do. A very different world. It was a world in which it seemed like living standards would continue to improve. It was a world in which people felt secure and confident about work in that sense, anyway. So there's a very relaxed attitude, particularly amongst younger people, to being in or out of work. Of course, at the present, it's radically different. Much higher levels of unemployment, much greater insecurity at work, longer working hours. I think, you know, British workers work as long, well, longer hours than many other countries. Not as long as the United States or Japan, but longer hours than many other countries. Real actual decline in living standards, certainly since the economic crisis of 2007-2008. You've got things like 0 hours contracts and so on. So it's a very much different world. So the reason I'm saying that is because people can be in very difficult economic circumstances, so that although Sanger actually was offering that advice, he was offering it in the context of the UK in 1968. And in different parts of the world or in different parts of the UK, it might be any work you can get is better than nothing. So it just means I think we need to be compassionate and careful before we jump to judgment about the kinds of jobs that people undertake. So there's some thoughts there from Sangharakshita. So that's some issues around work, and I'll come back to some possible discussion questions at the end where you might be able to focus on that. But I wanted to say something about community. Let me just take a drink. And I lived at Padmaloka, an immense community. I lived in an immense community in Birmingham as well with Vajragupta in the past. And people have been thinking a lot about the difficulties. Why is it that communities have declined in Sri Ratna? Maybe why is it that there's an renewed interest now? But when I was thinking about it, I read something that really inspired me about communities. And actually, it wasn't at all to do with Buddhism. It was Alain de Botton, who runs the School of Life, you may have heard it, and he wrote a piece on the Greek philosopher Epicurus. And I just found this utterly inspiring. And I wanted to share this with you because I think that having a sense of inspiration and ideal to do with something like communities is also very good. So Epicurus was considering the problem of happiness. And he said that we make 3 major mistakes in thinking about happiness. The first, he said, is we put too much emphasis on romantic relationships and not enough on friendships. Echo of something else there, I think. Too much emphasis on romantic relationships and not enough on friendships. Second, we are obsessed by money and careers instead of seeking meaningful and satisfying work on our own or in small groups, obtaining fulfillment through our labour. And third, and this is really interesting, I think, we dream of luxury. But behind the fantasy of luxury, Epicurus believed what we really want is a life of calm with time to reflect and to be with a good listener. That's interesting that Epicurus thought the desire for luxury, a life of luxury, hid a deeper yearning, which is a life of calm with time to reflect and to be with a good listener. Now, this isn't just what he thought and what he analysed. Epicurus, apparently, according to Alain de Botton, went on to take practical steps to implement his ideas. First, he decided to live together with friends, and he bought a modest plot of land outside Athens where he and his friends could live side by side with their own living spaces and with common areas, with shared childcare, and with everyone eating together. In this way, Alain de Botton said, he created the world's first commune. Second, everyone living in the commune stopped working for other people, taking cuts in their income in order to be able to focus on fulfilling work. And third, Epicurus and his friends spent periods of every day reflecting and discussing philosophical questions and the workings of their own minds. Fascinating. It'd be interesting to know if there was any connection between the ideas of Buddhism and Epicurus' ideas, whether there was in practice any connection. And de Botton says that Epicurean communities opened up all around the Mediterranean with thousands of participants at their height, thriving for centuries until they were suppressed by the Christian church in the 5th century. I had no idea. And I presume that what de Botton is writing is accurate and correct. I find that really inspiring. And I think it's worth having something like a sense of inspiration and ideal in our minds as well. That maybe we don't aim high enough sometimes. Maybe we don't aim high enough. So I just wanted to put that out there. And the final thing I want to add into your thoughts and for you to reflect on is Banti. Because Banti had, I think, an interesting take on individuality and individualism and the role of the Sangha. So Banti, Sangharakshita sees the distinction between individuality and individualism as crucial in relation to the Sangha. So for him, individuality is the process by which an individual commits themselves to grow and change. So individuality is the process by which an individual commits themselves to grow and change. Individualism occurs when a person is absorbed by self-concern. So individualism is when you're absorbed by self-concern. Individuality, he thought, naturally turns a person in the direction of meaningful connection with others to help foster each other's creative growth and development. And he said this can happen in the best of Sangha. That we turn towards each other and help each other to grow. And just as the poet Rilke declared that the highest task of a bond between two people is that each should stand guard over the solitude of the other, Sangharakshita identified as one of the characteristics of the individual that they encourage others to be individual in their own way. They stand guard over the others so that they can become individual in their own way. So individualism is rooted in selfishness and self-concern and leads, if you like, to the materialistic atomization of consumer society that is rampant today. And to cultivate Sangha, to cultivate the nucleus of a new society, is to help to cultivate individuality and to counter individualism. And to foster spiritual community then is to foster freedom of thought and the freedom to grow. I was going to say, I'm going to just throw out some ideas for things to you to think about and that you could talk about if you wish. In your groups this afternoon, there's other ideas that have come up in the discussion, and whatever you want to, that's fine. So, first thing you might discuss is this. If we remember what Schumacher described as the three purposes of work, and I'll just go through them just to remind you. First, to give a person the opportunity to make the most of their potential. Give a person the opportunity to make the most of their potential. Secondly, to overcome ego-centeredness by joining with other people in a common task. And thirdly, to produce goods and services needed for a becoming existence. If we remember those three aims, the last one is to produce the goods and services needed for a becoming existence. Well, it's basically, in other words, you're not producing rubbish. You're producing goods and services that are worthwhile and add something to human well-being.
To a becoming
existence.
And it's the second one.
And the second one was to help overcome ego-centeredness by joining with other people in a common task. So that was his three objectives, he thought, of a Buddhist view of work. But what can we do inside and outside Sri Ratna to help promote that vision of what work is about? It's a broad thing, but I think just to bear those objectives in mind. And then the second idea might be, how might we respond to Tim Jackson's idea of the three C's of care, craft and culture as areas in which jobs could be expanded? How might we respond to Tim Jackson's idea of the three C's of care, craft and culture? The third area could be, I talked about how the ideas and the practice of the new society in the 70s and 80s in some way grew out of the wider circumstances and movements in society at that time. So what are the existing movements now in wider society that we can learn from, that we can get involved in? Because, I mean, I heard about co-housing, and I've heard the name mentioned before, but I don't live in the UK, so I don't know. I hear about transition towns. And you know, what are the movements existing now in our wider society that we can learn from or that we can get involved in? And the fourth one, I think, comes very much out of the discussion that we just had. Can we experiment with new ideas for community living? What might we do there? I think that's that particular one. Can we experiment with new forms of community living? What can we learn and retain that's valuable in our past experience? But what can we do that's new? I've got a friend who, for a long time, he and I worked together in trade unions, and he's recently retired. But what he says for him is the key social and political issue of our time in the UK is housing. Yeah. I mean, he thinks it's woefully understated just how critical an issue this is. And it struck me that there's an opening there. There's an area in which we might be able to do something and experiment with. So some ideas there for you to think about. Okay? So we'll finish there for this morning.